This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida's primary was marked by high turnout, especially in Democratic races, a high proportion of mail-in votes, and in Central Florida, a wave of women winning election. Those victories included Amy Mercado winning in the race for property appraiser, ousting Rick Singh in Orange County, and Monique Worrell defeating a field that included former Chief Judge Belvin Perry in the race for state attorney in Orange and Osceola County. So what does that tell us about the mood of the electorate and what it might mean for November? Scott Powers is a political reporter for FloridaPolitics.com. Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Matthew. It's always a pleasure.
Let's talk about the state attorney's race in Orange and Osceola County. A lot of money being poured into that race and some big names there. What did you make of that and what kind of stood out to you about that race?
Well, you know, the critics of Monique Worrell, who won last night and essentially was elected, although she still must face an independent candidate in the November election, but her critics contend that she rode the same road to victory that Aramis Ayala took in 2016, which was a lot of help from outside groups that poured advertising into the campaign in the last couple of weeks and pretty much overwhelmed the opponents. Mm-hmm. Now, in Worrell's case, she's obviously a very good candidate for a number of reasons, and I know that her campaign has worked very hard to put her in a position to win. But it, frankly, would be hard for anybody to overcome the roughly $1.5 million that was spent on advertising on her behalf by outside groups just in August.
There has been a lot of focus, though, right, especially in the last few months, on law enforcement. So not just state attorneys' races, but also races for sheriff's office. And
sure.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit, Scott Powers, about the Orange County sheriff. John Mina winning re-election pretty handily there in his race, in his primary. But did we see some kind of challenges along the way because of the increased focus on law enforcement in recent months with the protests over the summer?
You would think we would have in yesterday's election. I mean, Andrew Darling had aligned himself with the street protest movement, with criminal justice reform calls. I mean, that was basically his campaign. And he was trying to ride the same wave that Monique Worrell wore. He didn't. He got clobbered, as did everybody else that was in that race against John Mina. I think in that case, what we saw was Mina has a long track record of professional law enforcement. He is well known. He's in place. He's the incumbent. And I think enough people thought he's doing a good job that issues of criminal justice reform and racial injustice and things like that really didn't overcome the respect that he's won from many voters.
Were you also following along, Scott, the races in Osceola County, paying attention to those two?
Some of them. The sheriff down there got upset. Mm-hmm. The clerk of courts down there, who's had a number of scandals, was ousted.
Yep.
There were some interesting races in the legislature races down there as well.
Just kind of on that law enforcement theme, Marco Lopez defeating Russ Gibson, and then Armando Ramirez being ousted too. It's going to be interesting, I think, to see what kind of reforms, if that's what's going to happen, that the elected sheriffs now bring about, maybe more so in Orange County from the sheriff's point of view. But what are you going to be looking for in those offices moving forward, Scott?
Well, in both of those races, the criticisms of the incumbents who are now out were that they were, I don't want to use the word scandalous in their approach, because I don't think that applies necessarily to Russ Gibson. But there certainly were some grumblings about how he was running that department all along. Mm-hmm. In Armando Ramirez's case, clearly there were scandals involved. He'd survived them all. He denied any wrongdoing all along the way. But I think people were tired of coming up every few years. Kelvin Soto, the Osceola County School Board member that defeated him yesterday, a solid lawyer, well-respected as a school board member, and I think people expect of him, and probably also Lopez down there, to bring about some stability, some accountability, and some integrity that that many people were wondering about.
On those themes, let's come back to Orange County for a moment, if we could, and talk a little bit about the property appraiser, Rick Singh. Another defeat for an incumbent mm-hmm. there. There's been quite a lot of print expended on Rick Singh and what's been going on in his office. Do you think the voters just said, finally, enough, we need to see a change here?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll find out over time whether or not taxpayers of Orange County win or lose there. I mean, I like Amy Mercado, who defeated him yesterday. She's a very strong personality. She's got a lot of integrity. She's been a good state representative for Orange County. Comes from a family that has been ingrained in Orange County politics for a long time. What she lacks is the one thing that Rick Singh claimed that he had as his best quality, which is Rick Singh has been, still is, a professional licensed property appraiser. He understands mm-hmm. the details of how to appraise property because that's what he does for a living. So this becomes an issue when you have the fine details of property appraising going on, and you get challenges from deep-pocketed property owners out there that say,
sure.
"No, you're appraising me too high. I want to challenge this. I think you're too high, and I want to pay essentially, I want to pay fewer tax dollars to Orange County."
Mm-hmm.
Singh has always maintained that he has been good for Orange County taxpayers because he's been able to get that money on the table. The flip side is his office has been a mess, and perhaps he's been responsible for a great deal of it. There have been so many allegations over the past couple of, really, 4 or 5 years mm-hmm. involving everything from political campaigning going on within the shop to sexual harassment to document destruction and manipulation to avoid bad findings in county audits. He's come out through all of those with no charges against him and maintains that he's done nothing wrong. But after the fourth or fifth time around, you just say, yeah, okay, enough.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of upsets, too, in the county commission races in Orange County, Betsy Vanderlei, a somewhat surprising upset there, I guess, although there had been quite a lot written about that race in the last month or so, especially with the Sentinel following up on that. What did you make of that race?
Yeah, you know, there are two or three things going on there. First, Vanderlei's long association through her employment with a company that does business with Orange County and with boards that she represents Orange County on caused clear, at least, images of conflicts of interest.
Right.
She's had to battle those. She's had to deny those. And, you know, all that coming weeks before the election is never a good thing. But they've been there for years, and she hasn't really striven to address them until the Sentinel broke it all in the last 3 or 4 weeks. Now, that's not the only problem that Betsy Vanderlei had. You know, the whole Split Oak controversy from last year and really mm-hmm. spilling into early this year, she voted for it, and people vowed to take her out for it, and Nicole Wilson vowed to take her out for it, and a lot of the support that came to Nicole Wilson, a lot of the, I think, votes that came to Nicole Wilson reflected how emotional and how passionate a lot of people were about that. That clearly affected Betsy. And then the third thing was, frankly, we saw an overwhelming number of Democrats voting compared with Republicans. It was a much, much stronger Democratic turnout than a Republican turnout. Now, that's a nonpartisan race. That's
right.
A nonpartisan office. But the Democrats lined up behind Wilson, and the Republicans were desperately trying to keep Vanderlei in office. And when you have a more than 2-to-1 Democratic turnout, which is what it looks like it's going to wind up being, that's going to favor the Democrat. And clearly Wilson beat her easily.
Do you see some signs then in turnout and the kinds of races or the victors from Tuesday night for the general election, Scott?
Yes, I think so. I think the Republican Party needs to look at what happened in this primary and be worried and decide they need to address something. Mm. And the something they need to address is Democrats took over the mail voting. You know, for decades in Florida and in Central Florida, Republicans have been very adept at vote by mail. In fact, they usually outdo Democrats in vote by mail. That's usually the way. This year, for political reasons that begin with President Donald Trump's constant criticism of vote by mail, things seem to be going very differently, and they went very differently in the Orange County election in particular, where Orange County Democrats were more than 2-1 voting vote by mail compared to Republicans. Mm-hmm. If that happens in November, it's going to have major implications for the November elections.
I know every election is different, Scott, but just a final thought from you on some of the big takeaways from Tuesday night. Of course, the turnout, mail-in voting, and a big night for Democrats. But who else kind of overall across all the races do you see as the winners from Tuesday?
Women, frankly. In almost every race that I looked at where there was a even remotely viable woman candidate, she won. Mm-hmm. It was truly a remarkably consistent record, whether you've got Amy Mercado knocking off Rick Singh for the Orange County property appraisers seat, or you've got Vina Francois winning the Republican primary in Congressional District 10, or Monique Worrell winning the state attorney race, and so on down the line. Kristen Arrington won down in House District 43 in Osceola County. Daisy Morales won in House District 48 in Orange County. Pasha Baker won in House District 28 up in Seminole County. And women won the Orange County Commission races. Women won the school board races. Literally, you have to go to two or three races in Volusia County and Brevard County and down in Osceola County to find any place where a man beat a viable woman in an election yesterday.
Well, it's going to be interesting in November, no doubt, as well. Scott Powers, political reporter with FloridaPolitics.com, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks to your listeners.
Still to come, in just 3 months, the pandemic recession erased a decade of economic advancement for women. Reporter Chabeli Karazana joins us to explain why women in particular are being hit hard by the economic fallout from the pandemic. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The pandemic has put enormous strain on working families, and the economic impact of the pandemic recession on women in particular has been especially severe. Reporter Chabeli Karazana covers women and the economy for The 19th. It's a non-partisan, non-profit news organization that focuses on women, politics and policy, and it launched just this year. In her article, America's First Female Recession, Karazana writes about the impact of this pandemic on women in the workforce, noting that in just 3 months, women lost a decade of economic advancement. Chabeli Karazana, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your first piece for The 19th was a really in-depth story about the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on women in the economy, in the workforce. But before we talk about that, I just wanted to ask you some questions about the website, because this is a brand new enterprise. So tell me about how long it's been around and the kind of the genesis of this, of The 19th.
Yeah, sure. So we are the first nonprofit, nonpartisan newsroom in the country that's focused on women, politics, and policy. And really, our mission is to elevate the voices of women who often haven't been or felt represented in newsrooms across America and also in news coverage across America. So women of color, in particular, underrepresented communities, and also people of all gender minorities. And so that's sort of the idea behind it, and we launched had a soft launch earlier this year and a hard launch about a week ago, as you said, and really excited for what's ahead.
So your first piece, America's First Female Recession, you go into do a deep dive into, you know, what this really means for women in the workforce, and you start with a story that's, you know, pretty powerful, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to relate to it. It's what it's like to be suddenly thrust into the situation where you have to work from home and you're trying to sort of balance that with childcare. And a lot of people have been sort of wrestling with this over the last few months, but just kind of walk us through how you approach the story.
Yeah, so that intro into the story is really, I think, a story that has resonated with a lot of women. I spoke to a mom in Austin, Texas, who is a consultant and does a lot of consulting work, and was offered essentially what was her dream job in March. A bad month this year in terms of coronavirus. And she, you know, was at home with her kids, like so many families. Her husband was a doctor, so he was, you know, in Austin working with coronavirus patients all day. And he didn't really have the option to leave his job, as they were starting to realize, you know, this childcare issue that we have right now with the schools closed, with daycares closed. We have two small elementary school age children that we need to deal with all day. And it was really not an option for him. And so she was put in this position where she realized, I cannot perform at work to the degree that I set for myself. And I also cannot perform at home to the degree that I set for myself. I'm both a terrible mom and a terrible worker. And so she essentially said, had to turn down the dream job at the beginning of the pandemic. And then she had this part-time consulting job she was doing as well. She turned that down. And so she was finding herself out of the labor force for the first time in her career and wondering, how are the decisions that I'm making right now going to affect me months down the road, years down the road?
And this was a theme in the course of your reporting. This was kind of a pretty common theme, like the discussion that she had to have with her husband and family about, you know, how to move forward through this. Is this kind of a conversation that's happening all across the country?
Yeah, it is. I spoke to another woman in Miami who was making a similar decision, and she hadn't decided yet. She's an attorney. Again, her husband's also a doctor, and she had three children at home. And so she was finding herself starting work at 10 o'clock at night after she had finished all of the assignments with her kids during the day, and then working until 2-3 in the morning, pulling her first all-nighters since law school. It was a completely, it's not a system that someone can sustain for months at a time or even a month at a time. And so she closed her practice, her office, and is sort of in this position where a lot of women, I think, are, of figuring out what's going to happen next, what happens in the fall, what happens in the next school year. You know, we know that, you know, schools, many schools are not going to reopen at the same rate that they were last school year. We know that childcare, that industry is absolutely devastated. One in four childcare providers lost their jobs this year. We're looking at half of the childcare spots in the country possibly going away by the end of the year. And so there are not a lot of options, and something has to give. And just because of the way that, you know, families are still made up in the year 2020, it's women who are most likely to make that choice.
And if you dive into some of the numbers in your story here, nearly 11 million jobs held by women disappeared from February to May. And you write that erased a decade of job gains by women in the labor force. I mean, that's a staggering reversal, right? Just talk a little more about the impact that this has had and what that means, you know, for rebuilding those gains.
Yeah, so if we look really big picture for a second, you know, starting in the 1970s, women really started to increase their labor force participation, right? And it was sort of steadily going up. Then we hit a milestone in December 2019. So think back pre-pandemic for a second. I know we haven't thought about pre-pandemic in a while, but December 2019, women became 50.04% of the labor force. They surpassed men. And that's only happened twice. The last time it happened was during the Great Recession. And that was because during that recession and the recessions prior to it, men were the ones most affected, right? So they were most likely to be in the fields that lost jobs. And they were also a larger portion of the labor force typically, right? So in 2008, 2009, women surpassed men. And then in 2019, in December, women surpassed men again. They were the largest chunk of our labor force. Then coronavirus happened, right? And so in those 3 months, you know, March, April, May, a decade's worth of job losses. And so what we're looking at now, as jobs, you know, begin to trickle back, we had quite a few jobs return in June, but a much slower return in July, is the uncertainty, right, of what happens long term. In previous recessions, we've seen that because men are typically more affected by past recessions in terms of job losses, the gender pay gap has actually narrowed a little bit. Because when you leave the labor force, when you're disconnected from the labor force and you don't come back for months or maybe sometimes years at a time, there are skills that depreciate. You're less likely to find a job at the same degree that in the same level that you were when you first left the labor force. And so what happened previously was that ended up narrowing the gender gap a little bit. Now, what we're going to see, because it's women who are most affected, that gender gap is going to widen a little bit. And even though jobs have come back, of all of the job losses we've felt since February, women are still 54% of all of those job losses.
How long do you think, or from the folks that you've talked to, what's the sense of how long it's going to take to kind of, you know, get back those job gains and sort of get back to the balance of, you know, female to male, or that ratio of who's in the workforce?
A lot of that is going to hinge on our response to the pandemic in the next few months, right? But there have been some studies that show that the gender pay gap will probably not return to where it was pre-pandemic for another decade. And so part of that is because if you think really long-term about what happens after a recession, right? And we've seen this before already. Students who are entering the job market at the time of a recession are more likely to see their pay cuts in the first year cut by about 10% than what they would have expected. They're gonna feel that for the first decade that they're in the labor force, right? We already talked about the gender pay gap, minimum wage hikes across the country. There are places that are considering them. Florida is one of them. Those are likely to stall because you're going to see a lot of opposition from businesses saying, we just can't do this right now. And we're already starting to see it. It already happened in Virginia. There's a minimum wage hike there that is stalled right now. And so all of these things compound, right? Women are most likely to be in those minimum wage jobs and those lower wage jobs in general. You know, women are, and so that, and that's going to apply as well for people who are graduating. And so when you put all of that together, it's really women who are going to feel that effect a lot more.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Chibeli Karazana. She is a reporter covering women and the economy for the 19th. Chibeli, I wanted to sort of ask you a little bit about the background too. You know, talking about those job gains, why is it that it's taken so long for there to be a little more parity, or for that the wage gap to narrow, and for the balance of women to kind of tip over the 50% mark when you look at the labor force? Like, why has that road been so hard?
You know, women didn't really, like I said, become part an active part of the labor force in a substantial figures until really the 1970s. So we're already behind, right? And then, you know, you have issues of occupational segregation, right? So initially, you know, women tended to be, you know, secretaries or in positions that often were lower wage jobs. Domestic service was a big one, you know, in the beginning. And so we've started to move away from that, where women have been able to permeate different fields and higher wage fields, but they're still at a disadvantage in many, many, many different areas. You know, I used to cover space. We just had the first woman who is heading the human space flight directorate at NASA. And so there are still firsts happening, and they're going to still be happening. And so the issue of representation is a really big issue in terms of getting women into those fields and getting them at the same rate as men, particularly when you look at women of color. You know, for example, there was a study from Lean In that came out this week, and it showed that for every 100 white men that are promoted, only 58 black women are promoted, even though they are seeking those promotions at the same rate, right? So they are just less likely, that those barriers still exist, and they're just less likely to move up the rung. And then you see that that has a ripple effect across everything. And it's why women are still struggling to reach parity. There's this figure that I think is pretty surprising. Of the 408 people, economists who serve on the Federal Reserve's board, only one is a Black woman. And so representation, I think, is a big part of it, and we're still working on that.
Thinking about representation too, with the folks who make the laws that could have some impact on this, what are we seeing there? I mean, is there a lot of movement in Congress to try and bring some balance about or advance some of these issues that women in the workforce have been fighting for, whether it's pay parity or equal access to employment and things like that?
So, you know, we're obviously still underrepresented in Congress and positions of leadership. And so what we've seen this year, which has been really interesting, is with particularly the childcare aspect, I think a lot more families are understanding that the issues that we've had with the childcare industry, which we've had for a really, really long time, this is an industry that, you know, operates on razor thin margins. You know, its workers are typically paid minimum wage, and families are typically charged pretty exorbitant figures for childcare. And so there's a gap there, right? So this is an industry that's been struggling for a long time. This year, everyone has dealt with it to some degree. And unfortunately, it has to get to a point where we have, to some degree, some men who are seeing, you know, this is, are in their homes and are seeing this is a problem. We are seeing higher wage, middle to high wage women who are affected by this, who otherwise might not have or might not have understood the issue. And so because this is affecting everyone now, suddenly childcare isn't on the back burner anymore. And so there have been proposals this year from House Democrats in the HEROES Act to include some money for childcare. Senate Republicans included money from childcare in their HEALS Act proposal. And, you know, former Vice President Joe Biden has released an entire 10-year, $325 billion childcare plan as part of his platform going into 2020. And so we know this is going to be a big issue. We know we're hearing it from economists. If you don't deal with childcare, we do not have a recovery.
What are you hearing from businesses then? Because, you know, there's obviously an economic incentive for businesses to try and get this right if it's affecting their bottom line. So are you seeing some companies kind of trying to make some changes, maybe be more flexible or take into account the needs for good childcare for their employees?
Yeah, so we are starting to see businesses be a little bit more flexible with a lot of their policies. Paid sick leave is another big policy that we've seen some movement on this year, which is, you know, the United States is one of the few countries that doesn't have a universal paid sick leave policy. And when you have a pandemic at the same time as an economic downturn, paid sick leave suddenly becomes important. And so we're seeing some of that. And we're also seeing companies that are starting to be a lot more flexible. For women in particular, working from home and remote work is something that they've been fighting for a long time, particularly working mothers. They need that flexibility. But we've seen that companies have been really reluctant to offer it. Well, now this year, they were forced to offer it because we are all sent home in March. And so, you know, in terms of silver linings, what we think long term is that a lot of companies will just be more willing to offer that remote possibility because they've already seen that it works.
Do you think some good will come out of the challenges, you know, facing the childcare industry, if we want to call it that? Like, is this going to radically change the way it works and maybe the childcare companies won't be operating on such thin margins and there won't be such a gap between what parents pay and what workers are paid?
I hope so. And I think we are starting to see a lot of discussion on childcare, again, because so many people are affected by it, but also because the situation with schools is also so precarious. We don't know what's going to happen, and that's going to vary widely across the country. So, you know, I spoke to a childcare provider in Oregon who told me before this all started, I had like 92 kids. She got a PPP loan. She was able to reopen as an emergency center. And so she's one of the lucky ones, right? She's not one of the ones that closed. Now they have 17 kids. So they went down from 92 to 17. So they're really, really, really struggling. And like I said, it has become a line item on several of the recovery packages. We still haven't seen what that's going to look like. You know, Democrats and Republicans have not reached a consensus on what the following recovery package would look like. But we know that it's very, very likely to be a talking point, particularly going into the 2020 election. And just the reality is that we're talking about it, we're hopefully going to address it.
Thinking back to the mother of two who you interviewed and who leads off your story, Alu Nasser, are you going to kind of check back in with her from time to time to see what's changed, you know, maybe 2-3 months down the track, or if things change in terms of the pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, she called me the day before our story ran last week and told me, hey, the dream job called back. And the owner is a working mother too, so she understood what I was going through. I talked to her about my situation, and she said, come back. You know, we still want you to take this job. And so she really feels, and she says this all the time, that she is one of the lucky ones, that she has the opportunity to make a choice at all. And the reality is right now, a lot of families don't. You know, her husband makes, you know, fairly good wages. She has the option to make that choice. And particularly for women of color and lower wage women who are often the only sole breadwinners in their families, they don't have that choice. And so, you know, we're going to be checking up with them. We're going to be checking on Elu. And we actually have a call out with our story for anyone who wants to share their story of being a working mother in this 2020 recession, or a working woman, or, you know, anyone who wants to tell us their story, because we think this is not going away, right? We have still months ahead of us.
Well, Chibeli Karazana is a reporter covering women and the economy for the 19th. It's a non-profit, non-partisan newsroom reporting on gender, politics, and policy. And the 19th just launched recently. Chibeli, thank you so much for your reporting, and thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, with businesses and schools reopening amid the pandemic, what are the legal implications? We'll talk to attorney and Professor Josie Balzac about a new field of law that's emerging, pandemic law. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Brick and mortar schools are preparing to reopen, and Orange County teachers are back on campus Friday for students who opted for face-to-face learning. So what are the liabilities for schools if kids or teachers get sick? And what about businesses reopening? Josie Balzac says there's a whole new field of legal practice emerging, pandemic law.
Josie Balzac is an attorney and assistant professor in the Department of Social Entrepreneurship at Rollins College. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
What kind of challenges has the pandemic thrown up for an attorney? And I guess, you know, law is such a vast field, but the kind of law that you focus on, what new things are you seeing in the last kind of 4 or 5 months that you maybe had not encountered before the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I think, to be honest, and I think that probably a lot of people can agree with this, as horrible as a time is that we're currently going through, I believe there are some effective and efficient things that are happening. So, for example, most hearings, so your typical trial lawyer would very often go to court for a 5-10 minute hearing, drive all this time, get there, and now they're able to have all of these hearings via Zoom. Right, just like we're having an interview right now. They're piloting trials via Zoom right now, at least civil trials. Criminal trials have not gone via Zoom. I think there's a lot more at stake, especially people's liberties, you know, when it comes to criminal trials. Client meetings and things are all happening via Zoom. So a significant changes are happening, and a lot of continuing legal education classes and things being put on by the Florida Bar and many other people is, you know, how do you practice now in the era of COVID and this, you know, horrible pandemic that we're going through? I do think that, you know, if we are thinking about the practice of law, and we were just talking about criminal, and I know we're going to get into a lot of different kinds of lawsuits and things that are on the horizon, but I think something very important, as I just mentioned, you know, criminal trials are not starting, and we have a Sixth Amendment constitutional right to a speedy trial. where a felony trial needs to come within 175 days. Clearly, we've been 5 months at this, right? So that 6 month time is about to pass. So I believe in the next couple months or before the end of the year, if the trials don't come back, you will start seeing some challenges from criminal defense attorneys for their clients who aren't able, who are stuck in jail, right? With no bond or for whatever reasons they can't get out and they haven't had that speedy trial yet.
Speaking of the Florida bar and doing things remotely, I mean, there are some challenges to that, right? I mean, the Florida bar exam was postponed or canceled because of some technical issues, and that is going to cause some problems for those students who were hoping to take that exam and you know, hopefully pass it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you've seen, I don't know if you've seen it or not, but if you go to like the comments of like the Florida bar, I mean, you can see these future lawyers, right? Already making claims about the potential types of lawsuits, perhaps that they're going to file against the Florida bar, right? I mean, first it was postponed. First it was supposed to be split, right? Between like Orlando and Jacksonville and Tampa or what have you. Then they decided to take it online. They then postponed the date from July to August. And then on Sunday night, literally like 48 hours, right before all of these students have been, and trust me, I've been there. It's hell for those several months, right? Your whole life stops. And then for the Florida bar to say, oh, just kidding, we're going to postpone it again, but we don't know when that will be. A lot of people are struggling because they took so much time off work. It's really hard to study for the bar and work at the same time. And so they're feeling as at this moment, they can't continue to take 2 more months or 3 months off of work, you know, to continue to study. And once you're in that prime, it's like, I remember I was the smartest person on earth right before I took the Florida bar. You know, a couple of weeks later, I became, you know, the dumbest person again. but for that time, right, all this information is in your head. So yeah, I mean, it's just such a struggle. You're seeing states all across the nation completely unsure. What do we do? Do we cancel the bar exam? Do we do it online? What do we do? Do we just let them become lawyers? You know, it's a very, very hectic time. And I think it's just like this era of the unknown. You know, in academia, the fall semester is called planning for flexibility, right? Because we have no idea the uncertainty of things that are coming our way.
Yeah, and speaking of academia, I mean, one of the big challenges that parents who have school-aged children right now are facing is, you know, what to do with their kids. We have the option in Orange County, at least, and in many of the counties in Central Florida, to send kids back to school in person. A lot of parents are opting to keep their kids back and have them take those classes online. But, you know, there are going to be some issues there. I'm wondering if you sort of think about it from a legal perspective, what kind of lawsuits could potentially school districts be facing, and what kind of conversations do you think, you know, those school districts' lawyers are having as they plan out this very uncertain future?
Right. I mean, absolutely planning for risks, you know, and I think there's going to be this premise of, God forbid, right, that anything happens, right? Let's hope that, you know, maybe the semester starts fine and, you know, we don't see infection, we don't see spread amongst the students, the staff, the faculty, or the teachers. But if there is spread and infections, you're absolutely going to see the potential for these kind of personal injury negligence lawsuits where parents are saying, you know what, school district, you didn't do enough, right? So these omissions that, you know, you failed to act in a certain way, you had a duty of care, you breached that duty of care, and that caused my child. And then perhaps like the domino effect. I mean, I don't know if we're going to see, you know, perhaps multiple different causes, like my child got sick, then I got sick, then my parent got sick, right? And then some types of lawsuits. Perhaps, I really do see lawsuits, especially when it comes to government. I really believe that government's going to be the culprit of many lawsuits moving forward. And I think part of it's going to be government, you're not doing enough. So it's whether individuals suing government saying you didn't do enough to protect me, Maybe it's local governments suing state governments or state governments suing federal governments. But I think on the opposite side, which is, you know, ironic today, we're in the primaries, the politics are very polarized. I think on the opposite side, you're also going to see people suing government saying, you're doing too much. You're taking my liberties away, right? You're forcing me to go virtual because some districts chose full virtual, right? So you're forcing me to go virtual, but I have to work, or you're mandating a mask on me and I don't want to wear a mask. You know, you're mandating a mask on my child and I don't want my child to wear a mask. Or you're already seeing it, bars saying you're mandating me to close and now I've lost my business. I've lost my rights to property, my rights to bear the fruits of my labor and my life, you know, those types of things. So I really do see it coming from you're doing too much or you're doing not enough, which I believe is the beautiful thing about law. It's so gray. It's black and white. It's really the epitome of there's two sides to every story.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Josephine Bolzac. She is assistant professor in the Department of Social Entrepreneurship at Rollins College. We're talking about law and the pandemic. Do you see a specific kind of law that's just pandemic-related emerging? Is this going to be something that future students of law will study and be proficient in a few years, do you think?
Yeah, I do. I really do. I think law has to be flexible. I mean, our founding fathers didn't imagine having to make laws on technology. Law has to be adaptive. I really believe stagnant water bears disease. And this is a new era for us. It's unprecedented. And when it comes to case law, which is how the judiciary, decisions coming down from the courts, is based on looking back through the doctrine of stare decisis of like, what are past cases? How have they dealt with this? And we don't have any precedent necessarily in this area. So I feel from, you ready for me to go down this rabbit hole?
Sure, let's do it.
So one thing I really absolutely believe you're gonna have coronavirus exposure like injury law, right? And so, well, a lot of people sadly like to call a lot of these personal injury attorneys ambulance chasers. Well, they're already advertising out there coronavirus exposure. Have you been to a restaurant where you got exposed? Have you been to a retail store?
So are you seeing the billboards on the highway now? Or are you expecting to?
Yeah, I'm sure we will start seeing. And I the other day saw a commercial for COVID lawyers. And they were specifically, though, for businesses, right? So I think in areas of insurance, too, like, businesses, you get hurricane insurance or all these kinds of insurances. But what kind of insurance do we have, like, when there's a pandemic that then stops my business? Are these businesses going to try to make claims? What are we going to see responding from that? I think a huge, huge area relevant to the coronavirus exposure are going to be nursing homes and assisted living facilities. You know, over 40% of the deaths in the U.S. come from these long-term care facilities. And in over 18 states, more than 50% of the deaths are coming from that. So you're going to see tons of lawsuits there. You're already seeing lawsuits with hotels, with airlines, with cruise lines. Remember, attorneys are always going to go after that deep pocket. Where can you get the most money? One interesting area, which I don't think a lot of people think about, is breach of contracts. So I have an obligation under a contract to perform a certain duty, but now COVID came and I'm claiming it's impossible for me to perform because a lot of contracts have these what are called force majeure clause that are quote unquote acts of God. So are courts going to say, yeah, actually that is an impossible defense that you can claim? We don't know, right? So I think a lot of these, the areas that I was talking about previously with the criminal aspects of things, all the entire legal community is already talking about this new area of law that's going to be called pandemic law. And I think that's more prone if this pandemic stays for a long time.
Mm-hmm. You talk about lawyers going after people with deep pockets, but some of those pockets aren't going to be so deep because we are in the midst of a pretty serious recession, right? I mean, it's not just governments, but also businesses are having to look at how to cut costs and, you know, faced with layoffs because of the parlous state of the economy. So is that going to put the skids on some of these lawsuits?
Absolutely. I think so. What will happen is if these businesses feel threatened in terms of, their economic situation, they're going to file for bankruptcy. And whenever they file for bankruptcy, then you have stays, right? So all kind of legal proceedings will stay the process. So yeah, I think that's going to be, a lot of people don't understand that, you could have a great claim, you could sue, you could win. The jury could say, hey, you're going to be awarded $5 million. The problem is going to be collecting that money. So I think that's where you're going to see a lot of the challenges for sure.
What about companies and their rights and responsibilities when it comes to getting people back to work? Because we've talked about educational facilities, universities, schools, but businesses too are figuring out how to move forward in this new remote work environment. Some businesses, it's tough for them to be completely remote because of the nature of their work. Some of them are also trying to figure out, how to make it fair for different employees. So how does that get navigated, and what are some of the risks that businesses might face if people have to go back into the office and then they're saying there's a risk of exposure to this pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you're going to see definitely a rise in workers' compensation lawsuits where, employees are getting hurt on the job. And you're going to also start to see a new area of pandemic law within human resources, right? What are the appropriate steps? If somebody gets sick, do we shut down? Do we quarantine that person? And then, depending on the steps that the employers are taking is going to be determinant of whether or not, someone says, hey, you didn't do enough. You knew so-and-so was sick, but never revealed that information to me. I think that it's a really tricky time. You need people to come back to work. We need our economy to thrive. But then you also have, the significant risk of people getting injured and hurt and the type of implications that that's going to have on businesses. So, I really feel bad for all these people having to make these really tough decisions because it's almost like they're stuck between a rock and a hard place and they have no direction because we've never been here before.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Josie Belzac. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Social Entrepreneurship at Rollins College and an attorney. Let's talk about the teaching that you do at Rollins College, the field of social entrepreneurship. Is that changing dramatically because of the pandemic? And do you see some of the changes coming about sticking around long term?
I think so. I think what was so incredible is how we really saw businesses respond during this pandemic, where you had breweries all of a sudden creating, hand sanitizers, and different companies, maybe if they did anything with fashion, started, making masks. And then, so I think that we were already moving to a recognition where people and society and consumers want businesses to do good. We want them to give to social causes. Look at what happened during Black Lives Matter movement and all the hundreds and millions of dollars that were given to all of these amazing nonprofit organizations. And during COVID as well, big, huge companies giving hundreds and millions of dollars in either actual product or services or just straight up cash. So I do think that because businesses recognize that consumers want them to do good, whether they're doing it out of, good intent or because it's kind of like a greenwash, we are starting to see businesses move in that direction. And I think because, you know, when we have so many different problems in the world and we recognize that government can't fix them all, Dr. Fauci was just, you know, interviewed by U.S. Chamber of Commerce and basically said that there's no way that we can't solve this crisis without the private sector. We need them to make the vaccines. We need them to make all of these things, right? So I do really think that we're going to start seeing businesses do more good, hopefully. I'm an eternal optimist, so I'm thinking positive here.
Josephine Belzac is an attorney and an assistant professor in the Department of Social Entrepreneurship at Rollins College. We've been talking about law and the pandemic. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It really has been a pleasure to be on the show with you this morning.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. When you donate right now to support WMFE, you're making all the news and information you rely on available for everybody free of charge. That service is as important today as ever, and it starts with your gift. Visit wmfe.org to make your contribution. And thanks. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.